All right, it's time for us to begin our Bible study. A couple of things before we begin. Number one, if I sound a little slow and tired, those are truthful statements. I am a little slow and tired. And so that's just how it's going to be for a little bit. Maybe I'll catch up eventually. No amount of caffeine is fixing this particular problem, I think. And so that's going on. But we are excited to get back into our Bible study this morning. And right now, let's begin that with a word of prayer. Would you all pray with me, please? Heavenly Father, we thank you for this day and the blessings that we share in Christ. We thank you for your word and the record of the ministry of your Son and the servants of the cross. Help us to be encouragers. Help us to be ones who take this message we read and to use it in a way that strengthens the faith of those that we meet and talk to. Help our life to be a manifestation of the life of Jesus. And individually forgive us of our sins. Help our relationship with God be strong and growing. And this is our prayer in your Son's name.
Amen.
Amen. All righty, as mentioned, we are in the Gospel of Luke. I think we're in chapter 23 somewhere. It's a bit of a mystery to my brain. And I know that we really should be talking about, as it says up here, the three series of events. I think Michael covered the death of Jesus last Sunday, if I'm correct. Michael can look at that and go, yes.
Sorry, go ahead and start where you want to start.
Yeah.
Sure, I missed some things, but we actually got into 24 a little bit. So go ahead and start where you want to start.
We're going to start in the middle of all this, and we'll get there, and it'll be okay. Everything's going to be fine. I did get to watch some of the teaching and listen to some of the work that was done while I was gone. When you're in captivity, you know, you've got to fill your time with something. And so I tried to be as profitable and as competent as I could in doing that, and I think we had some successes. But right now what I want us to do is to step back for a second and kind of look at a big picture of things before we dive back into the details. I figure that's a good opportunity for us all to get on the same page and to think about some of the things that take place. I was talking to David before Bible class about the way Israel exists in our minds versus the way Israel exists in practicality, like how it actually is physically and structurally as a community. And then how the stories of God shift when we are able to connect physical Israel, how God has laid out all those pieces and places in the land there with the people who are participating. Because almost everything in Israel, and we say this in Bible classes, is closer to each other than we're kind of familiar with. And this quick illustration I gave, I'm going to repeat here, but also talk about some things involving the death of Jesus and his resurrection in a second, is how we think about the story of Samson and Delilah. In that story, we kind of picture Samson as having to go on this big journey to find Delilah. He has to go far out. And physically, that's not the case. In the Tel community of Gath, where all of these things take place and where Samson's home is. And that's an excavated site in Israel where they know this is the area where he would have grown up and had his childhood. What you need to think about is this. Picture yourself on a very small mound. A tell is just a stack of dirt larger and larger. So a small mound. And your mound is positioned at the downtown center of Noonan. All right? So that's where your mound is. And that mound is the house of Samson. All right? So think right now, how far away do you think he has to go to find Delilah? And you go, well, he had to go out to where the Philistines would be, or out to the invaders would be, the other peoples. And so that's a picture you're in mind is like me. I often picture that as going, that's a journey. That's a half day, 2 days. It's something like he's way away from his family. That's not the case. The distance between Samson and Delilah is down the hill and around the corner. And so you haven't actually left the core of the downtown area to get from where we believe his house was and where her community would be. And actually, to really get to the other end of her community, you haven't left the city center and the big chunk that is Noonan. You're barely going out into the countryside. And so if you were to go, here's the easiest way to think about this. From the downtown core, the center of Noonan, where the courthouse, the old courthouse is, and go to Roy's house, to do that you would have to pass Delilah's house. And that would be way behind you. You know, maybe a quarter day's walk from his house to hers. So that helps us kind of think about the fact that his family and her family would have been aware of one another, would have been interacting with one another in the markets, in the various aspects of life as they work together. Now that shifts the story, right? You think about it differently. It's not as if he went and just found some woman way off afar. He's found a woman who was more likely to think about as being the bad girl next door. Like, that's really what you can probably picture a little bit better that way. Now, how does that change with our story of the cross and of Christ? Well, again, think about this. We've been reading about in our Bible class and our work through the Gospel of Luke, which is a very systematic and detailed account of many of the events that take place towards the last week of the life of Jesus upon the earth before the cross. And in that, sometimes the story presents a picture where we imagine these things to either be far apart by space of time or distance. But from the records of history, do you know that you can walk from the most likely, obvious, and certainly accurate site, that is the Golgotha skull site where he was crucified, to the place where his tomb exists in about 40 yards? So picture 40 yards. That's not even half of a football field. And you can walk from the place of the skull to the newly hewn stone tomb that was available to him because of a compassionate disciple. Does that change the way you start thinking about the proximity of these things? And both of those locations, by the way, which is now, if you're going to go to any kind of software on the internet and try to figure out what that is, they're both covered under what is called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And they don't look anything like you would want them to look. They're very much an old Middle Eastern Byzantine, that's like late Roman church. Very gaudy, very incense-filled, very over-gilded, but the locations are there. But here's the neat thing. You can stand upon the Mount of Olives, where Jesus often went to pray. It was kind of his outside of Jerusalem base of operations, and see both of those sites. You can stand there and go, there's the spire. That's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And I can see that. And you know what? You can walk that distance in a very short while. You can walk from the Mount of Olives all the way down and into and past the temple and into the walk that he would have engaged in on these last few days, which is something you've heard about before. I know I mentioned it before, which is the Via Dolorosa, which is the way of the cross. And it's the historic route that they think includes most of the places that Jesus interacted with in his last week. That helps us, again, reframe the way that we think about all of these events. And there's one more. And I've showed a picture before. We're not going to have that picture for Bible class today. But I want you to picture in your mind how you think about a tomb of Jesus looking like. The tomb in which would have come from a rich man, but he is not, and he's placed in there. They are almost like across that time period, they're all similar in style. And so your image of that is probably fairly accurate. If you're picturing a round stone that covers up the front of it, it's very accurate. And then inside, if you picture just like a little carved out space in the rock, you know what that looks like? All of the tombs of the Israelites in the first century. But only the tombs of the wealthy. And so you're kind of now visualizing the tomb of Christ in a way that's super familiar. And it's not very big. The stones for these tombs, actually not very big by my standard. Maybe it's big for other people. But you know, the top of these little round stones is right about here. You know, bigger than your 18-wheeler tire, but not bigger than a big D10 tractor tire, like the big Caterpillar tires. It's about this size. And that rolls in. And if you're going to go lay a person in that tomb, you roll that out, and you have to crouch down, and more than I can, then you bring them in. And they lay them in there in a flat, carved-out space. That's the physical setting that surrounds the events of Christ. And it's important for us to recognize this last little tidbit. If I were to tell you, hey, you know what? I'm not so certain about some of these Civil War battles. I'm not quite sure they happened. If, can you prove to me that these Civil War battles happened? What would you do living in Georgia? If I actually believed that, I don't, by the way, just for clarity. But if I didn't believe that there were Civil War battles, what would we do? You'd say, well, let's go. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go up north. Let's talk. There's a huge historic site that's a national park that includes a number of sites of battles. But what in Noonan? Do we have any history about the Civil War here in Noonan?
And antebellum homes with everything that goes with it.
All our antebellum homes that are here in Noonan, that's why the City of Homes, because they survived Sherman's March to the Sea. And what were they used as?
Hospitals.
And you'd be like, hey, you don't think the Civil War happened, do you? All right, well, we can show you all of this archaeological and historical evidence that says this is where it happened, and it happened here. And we could go down south to a prison, right? The Andersonville Prison, and go to that awful site and show all the graveyards. In America, we do that all the time with history. We take history that could seem esoteric or non-tangible or distant from children, and they go on field trips there. You know what, in Israel, what they do with their kids? They go on field trips everywhere. So everywhere you went, at every single biblical site you go to, there's two or three strings of different age kids going there to do a little bit of history. And so Israel is full of real, physical history. And the sites we're talking about in this biblical story here with Jesus are real, specific, concrete places. We know where the tomb was. We know where the cross was. We know the area in which the Mount of Olives and where the Garden of Gethsemane would have been. We know these things. We can put our feet there. That changes the way we think about Jesus, right? Because here's the connection. Let's talk about Robert E. Lee, General Number 1, or Ulysses S. Grant, General Number 2. Do we actually know those humans? No, but do we agree they lived? Like, we're pretty concrete that they lived, they died, they did stuff. We do that because history confirms it through all of the sources. So when you're talking to someone who's going, I'm not so sure about this resurrection story of Jesus, I'm not so sure about this death story of Jesus, to be able to go, no, this is the spot. This is the physical location where these things happened. You can shift the dialogue to not whether or not there was a person named Jesus. When we go to the tomb here, you can go, yeah, they everyone agrees that Jesus lived and died. So now you only have to talk about one more aspect, right? And that the tomb is telling us that one more aspect. The biblical text here in the resurrection setting of the tomb and what comes before it and afterwards is to take history, which we can all agree upon, and connect it with theology, God telling us things that we cannot see or touch, and building the bridge of faith that exists between the two things. Because there's aspects of our faith that aren't touchable, that aren't seeable yet. And so this is part of what's here in the text. So before I keep blathering on, because I've blathered enough, and I can feel like my brain is saying, maybe it's time for you to ask some questions. When you think about the tomb right now, and you think about the physical space, the death of Jesus, and what Luke is trying to teach us in this biblical story, what are some of your first reactions? And we're kind of in chapter 23, the end of it, and kind of introducing into chapter 24. And so we haven't really picked a verse yet. So you can kind of be around that entire space. Michael?
So coming back to what you just said a little bit, woman here taking that field trip with the school kids and you recently, and you talk about the tomb is there. Is that one of those places that they really believe this is the one, or is it near?
So the standard statement is for any place in Israel, it's here or near there, with a few exceptions. And these are the ones that are in the category of there's no other options. This is the consensus site for these locations. It's physically in the right space. History, very early after the resurrection of Jesus, when you start seeing people write about it, they say it's right there. Like, it's concretely, these are the locations. They are located outside the walls of the city at that time. And then immediately around 200, they start saying this is where it happened. So another site like that that's really obvious is the Sea of Galilee. That hasn't moved. Sea of Galilee is still the Sea of Galilee. It's the same space. And Israel has a lot of sites that are like, no, it happened here. We'll talk about one actually in our sermon here a little bit that's 100%, this is exactly where it happened. So it's definitely at this spot. Like I said, though, it doesn't look anything like it would have looked then, because it's covered by a church that has been in use since around 400 AD or so. And now it's a rock, which is the Golgotha, a big rock stone. And they say this is what, when you go in, you can actually touch part of the stone because the stone is exposed because it's rock. And the tomb site has been completely covered up by a massive edifice. And so there's nothing there that looks like it would have looked then, because they've turned it into an idol. In my statement about that, it's definitely been idolized in both places.
Rich? I think what you're saying now, and then kind of what we're reading at the end of Luke here, helps to solidify what's mentioned in the first two verses of the book. Right? Eyewitnesses who saw these things happen, who then passed that down through the generations, and so that's why people know where it's at.
Yeah.
They
have that same dialogue in history, because the process for identification of locations for this area, this little spot, is basically someone from somewhere else comes in and asks the question, hey, where did that happen? And they start doing research to figure it out. They read the Bible, and there's key marks of like, this was here, this was here, here's the wall. We know the wall was right there. And then the community also remembers where things basically were. And they ask that living community, where did that happen? Because this happens during a time frame where Rome has started to shift to a Christian practice in the way that they see themselves, their leaders come in and they keep going there and saying, I want to build something. Where did something happen? And so nearly every site of major significance immediately gets a brick on top of it of, we're going to build a church there. And when you do digs on some of those churches, you go underneath them and you know what you find? An older church underneath that one and an older church underneath that one. Because they've been doing that since very soon afterwards. Even, and this is a connection, even at the location of Caesarea, where Jesus did quite a bit of his work, where Simon is from, where Mary goes to live, at that location, what they believe was his house grows into a church. They stay there and worship there. And so it's a pretty normal historical aspect of stuff that we would do if you think about it more practically. As a congregation grows, they might be meeting in someone's home. They might buy a house and convert it into a church building. And then they might sell that church building or tear the house down and build a church there, a place to meet. And so these are all normal kind of historical tidbits. So that takes place here. And it also should help us, again, create a concrete connection between the reality of a Jesus who lived and a reality of a Jesus who died, and then the understanding of a Jesus who rose. And many of the sites that you can see there also have some of that too. Think about about this. The people who interact with Jesus in the events that lead up to his crucifixion, that include his entombment and lead to his resurrection. And those stepping stones that get us there, you begin to think about people like Simon, the Cyrene. Can you imagine being that guy? You ever standing around doing something unrelated to an event and get drafted? I don't know if anyone actually got drafted. Did anyone actually get drafted during Vietnam? So a lot of you guys got drafted. That wasn't what you're planning to do, right?
No.
Yeah, like everyone's like, nope, I was not planning to do that. And we just deal with it. We accept our circumstances, because I wasn't planning to do that. I can say literally I wasn't planning to be in Israel an extra week. I got chosen to stay, we could put politely. Simon, he's there for unknown reasons. We don't know the full reason as to why he's present there. But he is pressed into service to carry a load that the Son of God can't carry. His body couldn't carry it. we think about that little minor event and detail showing up to the text, and I think Rich and Michael have talked about this at different points in Bible class. Remember, this is a biblical record that is brought to us both by inspiration and perspiration. And so think for a moment the interview process that gets to assignment event. Hey, how did the cross make it from Jesus carrying it to the place of the skull? How to make that journey? Well, there's this guy, Simon. And he was just standing there. And he got pressed into service. That's the story in a nutshell. And then 10 years down the road, Simon has to still be grappling with his participation in that event. His name is suggests this, his context and space is Hebrew. That's where he's at. And so he's not going to be in that community, in that place. And so he's a participant in the greatest story to affect Israel, period. And he himself didn't choose to be. He was just there. Now we have the other participants, the secondary bits of the story. We'll think about the women who are present at both the cross and the tomb. So at the cross, which women get identified textually?
Mary.
Mary, right? His mama. She has a very unique front seat view to everything. Her setting, place, position in this biblical event begins at the outset, right? How quickly does she accept all of this?
I think she accepts it, but not knowing what the outcome is going to be. You know, she's been told by an angel that she has conceived a baby and yeah, it's going to be special. So from the outset, she knew something was special.
Right, so there's the level of acceptance. She connects with it. She understands it. She acknowledges it with her cousin, but her behavior is one that seems to trust much more than everybody else, especially as we get to post-adolescent Jesus. But even in the adolescent period, they assumed he was with a caravan. Totally normal, by the way, for that to take place, to think they're with the family, they're good. But her behavior, she knows he's more than just a child. And she knows he's more than just a young man. And then by the time we meet him in this last three, four year block, she knows he's more than a man. Because at the very outset, she's asking him to do things that you don't just ask when you're kids. Hey, could you handle getting gallons of more wine for a wedding, please? Like, just go take care of it. You know, the process to create wine is very physical and demanding. You're going to go out and you're going to gather up your grapes. You're going to squash your grapes with a group of people in your feet. And that grape juice is going to go through a little coveled out funnel in the ground and then sorted out and then sifted into getting the leavings off of it, all the bits and pieces and seeds and all that, and the shell and all of those things. And then they're going to gonna bottle it up, basically put it into the skins. She's like, no, Jesus, go handle it. Take care of it. Whatever he asks, you do that, and it's going to be okay. So she knows, accepts, and understands more than even the text sometimes implies. But now even here, at the cross, her sorrow is real. The sorrow of the entire circumstance is real, but she still knows more than everybody else in some ways. Bobby? Yeah, we don't know the rest of it. We also don't know the full dialogue of Jesus with everybody in the biblical text. So there's more that goes on that fleshes out bits and pieces. Yet Luke still gives us a really detailed, clear account. Notice this in chapter 23, verse 27. There's a group of women in this setting too who are mourning, who are expressing their sorrow for these events. We tend to think that everyone is happy with the death of Jesus that's not of his disciples, right? That's not the case. Death is still the enemy. And even those who may have been unaware of the various comments, concerns expressed by the leadership in Israel, when they saw a man going to death whom had healed, had been kind. Remember, he is one of the rare biblical instances where he's compassionate to fallen women in ways that are uncommon for their culture. Like, they know who he is, and this community is not massive. It's not a city where you can get lost in. Well, you can get lost, but you're not going to get, you know, not have a connection to the people next to you. Very interwoven, interlayered community. Again, a great way to think about it is think about how tight-knit the community is over by Carl's house. Carl's house has got where his little house is there. Everyone's kind of related, right? You got a lot of family around there. That's a way to think about the biblical families in Jerusalem at this time. This is a very interconnected community. Everyone kind of knows everybody else. And so when this son of Israel is being moved to the cross as if he is the worst kind of criminal ever, that sets our perception of these events as well. Jesus interacts with some of these events too. There's some interaction between Jesus and the setting here, and we get to Mary on the cross and the dialogue of, in essence, care for Mary in what way? What is John's new obligation?
Take care of her
in what manner?
As a mother.
Yeah, and by the way, that's not an uncommon thing, because think about this. When Paul writes to Timothy, what's the standard that Timothy should be using with women who are older than him? And men. Mother and father, right? Same age?
Sisters.
Siblings. Brothers and sisters. Younger? Younger brothers and sisters, right? This is this whole picture of this is your family, and you look at them and you see them as familial to you, as family members. That changes the way you treat them. Because here's the practical thing. A person you've never known loses their house. How quick are you to go through the mental process to let them into yours? Could take a bit, right? Let's check them out. Make sure they're safe. Get some references. Your mama loses her house. How many speeding tickets do you get between where you're at and where she is to get her into your house? Right? That's the level of connection that we're trying to see develop amongst Christians in both this biblical story, but also later down the road when we begin to apply these biblical truths. That brings our focus now to this event upon the place of the skull. It's a term that's in other gospels, it's Golgotha. And it's a place that exists just outside the city walls where this kind of event takes place. Now when you look at the city of Jerusalem, you're seeing expanded wall sections. And so the current walls that surround Jerusalem, the old city area, are far newer than this biblical event. But in the time of Jesus, where this is outside the walls. This is outside the core of Jerusalem and the core of the city. And this is where Jesus makes a very powerful statement. Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. So again, go back to Simon, who's there not by choice. Include Mary and the mourners and the other disciples who are close and still kind of hanging on. And Jesus makes a statement like that. They all believe, and Simon is confused, and we're confused about Simon, not so much he's not confused about who he is, but we don't know exactly where he stands, is witness to a man condemned as a criminal. Is he complaining about what's happening? Is he saying, this is unjust and unfair? I shouldn't be on this cross. Barabbas should be here in my stead. Is that the Bible record? No, it's actually the exact opposite. It says, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. There's no impetus on the part of Jesus to draw back from this next step. And in fact, there's a sense of compassion. When the assaults begin on his character and his person with things like, he saved others, let him save himself. Is that only a first century opinion? Or is that a every generation and even a 21st century perspective to life? Not just Jesus, but life in general. So again, go back to that moment where you and I have been pressed into service to help something that, hey, we're not part of that. That drives the way we think about these events. Just like we thought about whatever we were asked to help with that we didn't plan to be part of. Didn't want to be part of. And now Jesus is listening to that assault upon his nature and his character. And unlike you or I, he has the ability, the capacity, and the power to do far more than we could in response to that. Had Jesus in the past already demonstrated his power enough to silence or to redirect physical spaces to his own good? He's like, yeah, fig tree, take a break. You're going to die now. You're going to grow now. You're going to do stuff. Just because I say so, because I need to teach something. You're going to become, basically, fig tree becomes PowerPoint, is a way to think about it. It's a visual aid at that moment. And it was just trying to be a fig tree. Just do its normal thing. Well, Jesus, in many instances, dealing with humanity, with animals in various places, had changed how things normally would go to teach or to rescue, even affecting the storms, the winds, the rains as needed. And so in that shift, you see someone who is the anointed, the Messiah, choosing to not act for, as we sometimes say, the greater good. Chapter 23, verse 41 is an acknowledgement from the outside, looking to the inside. Because even though it's coming from others next to Jesus who are convicted, their statement is accurate, right? This man has done nothing wrong, and we ourselves are justly here. Like, he shouldn't be incarcerated with us. He's legitimately not a criminal. I find that part of the text interesting to me in two ways. One, how exactly did they figure that out?
Probably just by the things that happened immediately after he died.
Yep.
The earthquakes and the darkness during the middle of the day and all this stuff.
Right, and even, but right now we've got these criminals who are arguing about the nature of Christ while they're justly criminals. I think part of their answer is super obvious. A criminal knows his own kind. But also, Jesus is well known in the region. He's not known to be a zealot or a fighter or a rabble rouser or an overthrower. They know that. Bobby?
They probably
were
there for the trial, too.
You know, and they got to understand some of these things that happen publicly are available to all. And we don't know where these two criminals were at that particular moment. But these are public spaces where some of the last things involving the trial of Jesus take place. Some of them are exactly where they used to be. And you can stand in some of these places for the public actions. You can actually stand in the place where Paul riled up the crowd in the book of Acts because he was on trial for the resurrection of the dead and caused a basic riot in Jerusalem. You can stand in that space on the dirt side. You can't get up in the fortification very easily where he would have been interacting, but you can be there. So here, but there's one more thing. They talk about the kingdom. And they make a statement about when you come into your kingdom. So for whatever's going on with these two men who are next to Jesus, one of them very quickly understands that the kingdom that Jesus is going to isn't the expected kingdom of the day. When you talk about the zealots of the first century, their idea was we're going to overthrow the Romans and be Israel again. And our Messiah is going to come, throw out all the infidels, and we'll be on top in the strata of the area. And we'll be all good and grand. This criminal sees what's happening to Jesus, knows he's dying, and sees the potential for more than just what he sees. He's acknowledging, recognizing, and connecting that there's more going on here. Now, he doesn't tell us with explicit terminology what he thinks the kingdom will be, because we don't get a big theological discussion of what his comments are. We imply one, right? So when we go back to this text and we read about this criminal statement, we reverse engineer the kingdom this man is talking about. As we know, right? This can only be concerning the kingdom. But remember, the thief is A, not inspired as far as we can tell. There's no record of him being a prophet. B, his knowledge is going to be equivalent to human knowledge that day. He doesn't know what's about to happen. So when he says, when you come into your kingdom, remember me, all we have to go on is that this guy has the kind of faith that says even a man on the cross is going to do something extraordinary. His statement is future looking, but no certainty. He couldn't write it out. Some of these things haven't even been revealed yet. Further, the apostles' understanding, the disciples' understanding, and our understanding doesn't even get fleshed out for another 50 days. And they don't even begin to figure it out for 50 days. So this statement here is super bold because of the level of potential ignorance in the one who says it. But also it combines with his obvious faith. Now, we add one more caveat to be fair to it. Is he desperate? Is a man on the cross about as desperate as you're going to get? Yeah. But that gives it a greater sense of reality than would have been there otherwise. He's seen all this go down. He's like, look, my only hope is in this guy right here. The world has all failed me, but this guy is my last hope. Bobby?
This thief was about to die. And I think he looked at death different from what we look at. We look at death as the end of life. But if we live obedient to God, death is the beginning of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we don't know what's going on with the thief theologically. We don't know the depth of his faith. But understand this. Israelites, the average Israelite, the sons of Israel, not the arguer scribes, Pharisees, Sadducees, etc. They believed in life after death. They believed that there was more than this earth. They believed in the concept of heaven. And so there's a level for this guy right here who easily would understand that Jesus is a prophet, because almost everyone understood him to be that, is the real only source for him to make himself right with God. Go talk to a prophet, because a prophet can talk to God. So he talks to a prophet who's being crucified because he said he was the Son of God, the Messiah, the Anointed, and says, remember me, because he knew what the Messiah would be. Like, that's a known concept in Israel, that the Messiah is their Hamelech, the king. But it's a new king. Michael?
Was he desperate? He's an in-the-moment example to all of us and a reminder that Jesus really is the only hope.
Yeah.
We don't have hope without him. This guy didn't mean it. He knew it.
Yeah. Like, it's clarified. It's specific. It's understood that this is well-recognized reality for him. So the questions are back. You got a couple weeks off of the questions. But they haven't died off completely. In this part of the story of Jesus, the history of God's redemption of mankind, what was the part that you looked at? You're like, man, I'm so thankful. I really like that that part is there for me to understand. It was good for me to know that. Or something similar. In our little first, you like it.
Well,
question, Michael.
You and I, we texted a little bit about this week in 1 Corinthians 13, where love doesn't take into account a wrong suffered. You know, when I look at Jesus saying, forgive them. And looking at that verse in this verse, I realize I missed that my whole life, most of the time in my behavior.
Yeah.
Most of the time in my behavior, I get mad. Jesus didn't get mad. He suffered this wrong.
Yeah, his commitment to his identity is absolute. Most of the time, our struggles with attitude, emotion, and behavior are when our commitment to our identity as Christians is struggling. And we start to take on an identity of the world, an identity of our own making, and we act like we're becoming. And then we draw ourselves back to the cross, and we draw ourselves back to Jesus, and we try to fix that disconnect between the two. How many have questions you want answered? I don't have enough limbs to identify the number of questions that I want answered about the crucifixion of Jesus. But what would be one that you think would be a learning point for everyone to think about? Or one you just want to ask?
Well, Donna? I have a feeling that at this point, Jesus is on the cross, and he knows that his bodily life is over, and he's going back to heaven. And I think, hopefully, we will feel the same.
There's a whole lot of the intersection between fleshly humanity, the body that God crafts for our divine representation, that we're an image of divine, and we're made in the image of God. But Jesus is different in that he is God. And so the Johannine or John 1 combination of the Word made flesh at this moment is a major mystery to me. The Bible actually talks about some parts of it. The Hebrew writer says a body was prepared for him. James talks about his humility impacting this transition between divinity and humanity. But he never actually gives up being God. And he takes on humanity. We, who are made in the image of God, have life breathed into us. We are similar to God. And yet we experience some of these things in different ways. And that interaction to me is a mystery that even in the detailed text of the scriptures, I don't fully understand, but I absolutely accept. Like, I accept that that's taking place. I don't have a clue as to how it all works out. And if your mind is like my mind and there's a mystery on the table that you can't solve, it takes up a lot of mental power sometimes unintentionally pondering what that works out. I think that's our clock going off for class today, and so we're going to have to stop right here. We didn't pick a specific verse to end at, but that's intentional because we'll continue a little overview as we get into Bible study next week, and we'll look forward to that Bible study for everyone to participate in. But thanks. It's been a good study.